Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of the embattled National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who during the transition made phone calls to the Russian ambassador that were intercepted by the NSA, prompting then Acting Attorney General Sally Yates to alert the White House that Flynn was exposed to potential Russian blackmail and had lied to Vice President Pence, all of which President Trump was informed about more than 2 weeks ago. The former Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, who for the last 3 years was a special assistant to President Obama for national security, Charles Kupchan, joins us. He just left the White House on January the 20th, and we will discuss the disarray and dysfunction in the Trump White House's National Security Council and how the Russian story that the White House and the Republicans were hoping would go away has come back into the headlines, adding weight and urgency to growing calls for an independent commission to investigate Russian involvement in our election. Then we look into the public assassination of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un's older half-brother, who was killed at an airport in Malaysia's capital by two female operatives who placed a poison-laced cloth over the victim's face, then escaped in a taxi. Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, joins us to discuss the ruling Kim family dynasty's ruthless purges of relatives and their long history of conducting brazen political killings on foreign soil. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and lived there for more than a total of 12 years. He joins us to discuss the sanctions announced today at a White House press briefing by the new Treasury Secretary against Venezuela's Vice President, Tariq El-Aissami, who is accused of being a drug kingpin with tens of millions of frozen assets, as well as a supplier of Venezuelan passports to Hezbollah operatives. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. And he is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Thank you. Good to be back with you.
And it's good to be able to talk to you now that you're out of government, but your successors, the administration that just came in, has been pretty much in a state of chaos from day one. And now it's culminated a little more than 3 weeks into an administration with the resignation of the National Security Advisor, who's the head of the National Security Council, which is not fully staffed, as I understand. So it would seem that if you already had disarray and dysfunction, losing General Flynn, for better or for worse, is not going to, well, let me ask you, is it going to make the situation better or worse?
Well, you're right to point out that they've gotten off to a very bumpy start. Part of it, I think, is that they did not expect to win the election, and as a consequence, they were not ready to hit the ground running. We had prepared quite a few transition papers, and we're ready to meet with the team, but they were very thin on the ground after the November election, and that was just a sign that they weren't prepared to enter on day one and get things headed in the right direction. And I think what we've seen is a very small circle of close advisors to President Trump attempting to guide the ship of state with very little input from seasoned professionals, either those that are already at the NSC. And even though I left and a number of other political appointees left, the vast majority of the NSC staff is still there because they are career civil servants. They haven't integrated them as they might. So whether, you know, is it good or bad that General Flynn is on the way out? Bad in the sense that it means that there will be further delay in getting their act together. Potentially good in the sense that it opens the door to hiring somebody who may be able to provide more steadiness and not engage in some of the activities which we've learned of in the last few days. That is to say, trying to potentially cut a deal on sanctions with Russia before the administration is even in office, and not being fully forthright with his colleagues, including the vice president, on the nature of that conversation with the Russian ambassador.
And, of course, it's pretty hard to understand how a former head of an intelligence agency would not realize that the National Security Agency monitors phone calls in and out of foreign embassies, in particular the Russian embassy. And, of course, that information was quickly passed by the acting attorney general to the White House counsel several weeks back. And that's raised some questions about the old Watergate adage in terms of President Trump. What did he know and when did he know it?
You know, we still have a lot of homework to do and a lot of facts to clarify about what went on. What was the nature of the discussion with the Russians? Are there business dealings between the Trump empire and Russia that we need to know about to make sure that there aren't conflicts of interest? I think this story is not yet over. But clearly, I think the administration found itself in an untenable position in which Flynn appears to have lost the trust and confidence of the president, the vice president, and other key people in the White House. The one thing I would say, that is positive is they did not let this drag on. They acted pretty quickly, and I think it's the right thing to do when you have a situation like this. Sometimes you hunker down and you stick your head in the sand. They did not do that. They have acted pretty quickly to move on. Let's hope that they find a very good person to be the National Security Advisor.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. He's now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Of course, General Flynn doesn't seem to be going quietly. He tweeted out that he was a scapegoat, and I would imagine that he could be a loose cannon if there's some bitterness there, surely, because, as I mentioned in the opening, we don't know what really went on during this campaign with Russia's involvement. We certainly know that the consensus of the intelligence community was that the Russians interfered and that they interfered in order to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, and that these directions came from the very top, from Vladimir Putin himself. That in itself is pretty explosive information, but there's been a detectable reluctance on the part of the Republicans to pursue this. And even now, with this breaking scandal, Jason Chaffetz of the House Oversight Committee is not calling for any investigations. The Democrats are calling loudly for investigations, particularly a 9/11 type commission. I take it this in the broad sense, Charles Kupchan, this firing or the resignation of General Flynn has sort of revived what some people thought was a flagging effort to investigate. And I must say, on top of all of this, the president himself, who has a cloud of questions of legitimacy about himself and his own presidency, one would think he would want to remove that cloud, and he's not shown any inclination to do so. So a long-winded way of saying, do you think that this incident has breathed some life into the possibility of a real inquiry into what happened during these elections?
You know, as to whether Flynn goes quietly or maintains a public profile and discloses information, it's simply too soon to tell. I think the Republicans in Congress would be wise to show some spine and to speak up a bit more on the sense that, I mean, I think everybody would agree across the political spectrum that this White House has gotten off to a very bumpy start, and that we need input from members of Congress, we need input from the courts, we need our checks and balances to be operating fully. So when it comes to this investigation, when it comes to a thorough discussion of the travel ban and what's next, I would hope that our Republican colleagues join the Democratic colleagues in trying to push things in a positive direction. But as I said a second ago, this story is not over. There is an enormous amount of energy being applied from the newspapers and from the media to get more clarity as to the situation, what was discussed with the Russians, where are we on policy with Russia. President Trump, as a candidate, said some things about cozying up with Putin, was laudatory about Putin, made some dismissive comments about NATO or about Ukraine and the possible recognition of Crimea. So right now, it's, you know, I would say we're all waiting for some clarity about the direction in which this administration is going to head on the most fundamental issues of foreign policy. And now with Flynn gone, it's safe to say that there is very, very little expertise in foreign affairs at the upper reaches of the White House. You've got the president, you've got Mr. Bannon, Stephen Miller, Priebus, the chief of staff. With Flynn now missing in action, it's hard to point to anyone who can bring to the table capability, knowledge, expertise. And having just left the White House January 19th, I can tell you that we face some of the most complicated issues in American history, whether it's Turkey and Syria and Iraq, whether it is trying to deal with the populism that could undo Europe. Lord knows we need capability, insight, and expertise at the top levels of the U.S. government.
Well, Charles Kupchan, let's focus on Europe, which was your specialty, both on the National Security Councils of President Clinton, and as you just pointed out, you just left the Obama National Security Council after 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security and with a focus on Europe. What we're talking about here in terms of what the Russians appear to have done in our elections here, which, again, the consensus of our intelligence community says happened, and they believe it was directed by Vladimir Putin himself. My understanding is that the Russians have turned their attention now to these important elections in France and in Holland and in Germany. So is this an ongoing methodology, this kind of cyber hybrid? Well, it's called hybrid warfare. Some people have suggested that, in effect, Putin has already declared war on the United States, not in the full-blown sense that implies, but in these more covert ways.
It's an ongoing problem. I wouldn't say that the Russians have now turned their attention to Europe, because they've always had their attention on Europe over the last several years. They're present in the media. They're present on social media. They have operatives in these countries. They fund far-right parties. They fund parties that are attempting to fragment the European Union. And they're very good at what they do, in part because, unlike here in the United States, they don't have a problem with state intervention in the media. And you've got Russia Today, and you've got Sputnik, two channels that are broadcasting across Europe, oftentimes in the native language of the country in question, and they're quite influential. Could one go so far as to say that President Trump would not have won without help from Russia? Would the United Kingdom not have voted to leave the European Union had the Russians not played a role in the public narrative? I don't know. No one can answer that question, but they are very aggressive in this space, and we need to find a way of countering it, not just in a technical sense, that is to say, how can we protect our networks, how can we make sure they're not getting into our servers, but at the broader public narrative, to push back against the more conservative, more nativist, more nationalistic propaganda that is coming out of Moscow and infecting all Western democracies.
Well, already there are now press reports suggesting that some elements of the so-called Steele dossier that was briefed to both President Obama and President-elect Trump, not the salacious parts of it, but some of the timeline involved, has been verified by U.S. intelligence. Those reports have come from CNN and from Business Insider. And there has been also reports in the British press of a roll-up of top CIA assets in Moscow at the highest levels of the Russian government. FSB, former KGB general Erevinkin, found murdered on Boxing Day. Others were arrested in a very public way with bags over their heads. So that would suggest that on the Russian side, there is a counterintelligence effort underway to react to those people that perhaps were named, not named, but named, referenced in the Steele dossier. So that again leads me to this extraordinary puzzlement that, you know, if you got the Russians acting on to silence what they consider to be leaks on their side, on this side, why aren't we learning more about what really happened?
Well, you know, I think that as we were talking about a few minutes ago, Ian, there needs to be more bipartisan support for a full inquiry into the situation. And when you have our intelligence agencies agree with quote-unquote high confidence that the Russians were mucking about in our electoral cycle and attempting to favor one candidate over another, that in itself is a reason to kind of man the barricades and get to the bottom of it. And so there's a lot of information out there that we need to clarify. And I think it behooves both our public officials as well as our media to keep digging until we get the facts.
Well, just in closing then, Charles Kupchan, it doesn't appear that the president himself recognizes the full scope of the disquiet within the public, and not just amongst the partisan Democrats, for example, but I think in general people are wondering about, and first of all, a lot of people, the people that you've been dealing with abroad must have wondered what the hell was going on with, you know, hanging up on the Australian Prime Minister, one of the country's closest allies. So there's been some questions around the country and within the country itself. There have been some questions abroad and within the country itself about who's minding the store in the fundamental sense. And the tweet that came from President Trump today in response to this resignation of General Flynn and the apparent disarray within his own White House, this is the tweet. The real story here is, why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington? Will these leaks be happening as I deal with North Korea, etc.? So that doesn't sound like the president's sort of recognizing what's even happening around him.
Well, I think it's safe to say that that's a diversionary tactic to try to get people to focus on the question of a leak rather than the core issue itself, which is the relationship with Russia and the discussion that General Flynn apparently had with the Russian ambassador. I do think part of the problem here is that the president comes from a background of running a large company as a family business, where he had a very tight inner circle, relied heavily on his own family, and he seems to be, at least for now, trying to replicate that and to have a almost hermetically sealed inner circle of individuals, many of whom have no political experience to speak of. That is a disaster. That is a recipe for just running off the rails. And so I think I would encourage the president to look back at his first few weeks in office, realize that he needs to broaden the circle, get input from a wide array of experts, make sure that Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and others are fully engaged in discussions, because so far the insular nature of decision making in the White House is very worrisome.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security, and he's now a professor of international affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the brazen assassination of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un's older half-brother. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you very much.
And the assassination of the older half-brother of Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator, was pretty brazen. It took place at the airport in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia's capital, and it involved apparently two women assassins, one of whom came up behind Kim and put a cloth over his face that was laced with some kind of poison. And he was, immediately immobilized, went to a clinic there at the airport. The ambulance would take him to the hospital, and he died on the way. So whatever they administered was pretty lethal and probably pretty exotic. But again, very brazen. So I take it, though, this is not new for the North Koreans. This is not out of character.
Well, North Korean assassins have in the past murdered in cold blood Kim Jong-il's nephew. That would be Kim Jong-nam, the one that was assassinated a day ago, his cousin, who defected with his mother to South Korea in the 90s and wrote an expose on the Kim royal family. So he was killed, Lee Han-young, in 1997. And since then, we've seen many cases of attempted murders by North Korean assassins brazenly in South Korea. We've seen convictions of North Korean assassins who were unable to carry out their orders but arrested and convicted in 2008, 2012. So in that context, this is nothing new. It is rather chilling, of course, and that's the intended message. I think this latest assassination of Kim Jong-il's eldest son sends a chilling message to all would-be challengers to Kim Jong-un. You dare, beware, disobey. You challenge me, and this is your grim fate that awaits you. And in reality, Kim Jong-un's Korean kingdom operates like a giant criminal syndicate in which counterfeiting of U.S. $100 bills, drugs trafficking, drug selling, human trafficking, and murdering family members are the accepted norms, if you will, the basic, irreplaceable mode of operation. So in that context, it's not particularly surprising, but it does send a chilling message to any would-be North Korean defector, any would-be North Korean challenger to the throne.
But normally, these kind of mafia type hits are done by, mafia hitmen, hitmen being the operative word. And in this case, it's women. And the North Koreans seem to have used women before, have they not?
They have. The most prominent North Korean murderer, I guess, or terrorist is Kim Hyun-hee, Miss Kim, who was only 21 years old when she, with her male accomplice, a much older North Korean man, planted a bomb on a Korean airline civilian aircraft leaving Baghdad bound for Seoul in November 1987. And then the two got off at a stopover in Abu Dhabi, and the plane went on and it blew up in midair across above the Andaman Sea as it was approaching Thailand. And everyone on board, 115 people, were killed in that terrorist plot. That was an attempt to dissuade international travelers, tourists, athletes, and so on, from coming to South Korea in 1988 when South Korea hosted the Olympiad, the Summer Olympic Games. So that was a brazen act, and Ms. Kim, the young woman, was arrested. She tried to commit suicide, but she was unsuccessful. She was transported back to South Korea, and under interrogation over several days, she caved. At first, she speaking perfect Japanese. She claimed to be a Japanese citizen, but she confessed that she was a highly trained North Korean spy, and this plot was the direct order of Kim Jong-il, who was the heir apparent to the throne back in the day in the 1980s, the father of the current leader. So this kind of, you know, malfeasance really runs in the family.
And again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. And, of course, it turns out Malaysia is one of the few countries left that has relationships with North Korea. In fact, they don't even require visas to travel to and from Malaysia. And that would seem pretty odd to think that Kim Jong-nam, he must have known he was on the hit list, wasn't he? I mean, what kind of security did this guy have? Yeah, I know he's traveling under a different name, but still, obviously they got to him and killed him.
Well, he probably would have been safer had he stayed in China, where he has lived for many years since the 1990s. He is the eldest son of the late leader, Kim Jong-il, the father of the current leader. And primogeniture runs in Korean history. The eldest son usually is the one to whom the family assets and titles are given. So many people correctly assumed that Kim Jong-nam would be the next leader, and indeed he was groomed as the heir in the late 1990s until he brought dishonor to the family, if you will, when in May 2001, in trying to enter Japan with his wife and a young woman, a maid, and their young son, his young son, they were apprehended at Tokyo Narita International Airport for trying to enter Japan with fake passports, a fake Dominican Republic passport. And the authorities didn't know who he was at the time. And under interrogation, he said he's Kim Jong-il's son. And when asked, "Why are you trying to enter Japan?" he replied purportedly, "To take my son to Tokyo Disneyland." So that layer of perhaps levity or absurdity made the Kim family regime look ridiculous. Disneyland, according to North Korea, would be a symbol of the evil, corrupt, capitalist American society. There are probably other reasons that Kim Jong-nam was eventually sidelined as the next leader, but my point here is Kim Jong-nam's continued existence, on a small scale, admittedly, but in real terms, poses a potential threat to Kim Jong-un. There have been reports, unconfirmed, that the Chinese authorities favored Kim Jong-nam and one day may remove Kim Jong-un from power and then use Kim Jong-nam as the new face, a proxy that would be obedient to China. But I think, more to the point, I think the purpose of the assassination is to send a message to all other North Korean officials: don't even dream of doing it, challenging me.
Well, there is some kind of rumor, I guess, that this Kim Jong-nam, who was just assassinated, the oldest son of the former dictator, who's the half-brother of the current dictator, he indicated he wasn't such a hardliner. That's what I understand. He told Japanese television in 2010 that, "Personally, I'm against third-generation succession. I hope my younger brother will do his best for the sake of North Koreans' prosperous lives." And, of course, we know that people are starving in that country, and prosperity is only visited upon the elite. So am I making too much of that? You say the Chinese thought perhaps they could maybe substitute him at some point or other for the current guy. But the current leader seems to be striking out like crazy. And also, I understand that Kim Jong-nam was very close to the uncle who was murdered by Kim Jong-un.
That's right. And while I see no evidence of Kim Jong-nam, the eldest son who's been killed, as a reformer, it is true that he did, in fact, come out very publicly and admonish his younger stepson, who was at the time in 2010 when Kim Jong-nam gave the interview with a Japanese TV station in October 2010. Kim Jong-un was the heir. He was declared the next leader. So the timing was not a coincidence, I guess. That kind of bold criticism of the next leader would not sit well in the North Korean political system. If an ordinary North Korean said that, he or she may be whisked off to a concentration camp or even killed. That it came from a major family member of the royalty, that is a death, an invitation to be murdered. So Kim Jong-nam has been a marked man, and I don't know what the timing of this is, whether they finally were able to get to him, or whether this is all premeditated to rub him out at this particular moment, at the start of the new U.S. administration. I don't know what the intricate inner workings are, but probably Kim Jong-nam had a short lease on life as of 2010. He has a son who's a young man, and he gave an interview with a Norwegian television station a few years ago, came across as very thoughtful, articulate, spoke good English, and even said that he would wish to work toward advancing, improving human rights in North Korea. That is also unacceptable from Kim Jong-un's point of view. So, you know, I fear for many people, innocent people who may be implicated in this incident and be sought after by North Korean assassins as well, including the uncle's wife. Now, that would be the former dictator Kim Jong-il's sister, who was married to Chang Sung-taek, who was the number two man in the North Korean hierarchy until he was violently purged, killed by Kim Jong-un in 2013.
Was he the fellow that was put in front of an anti-aircraft gun and blown to pieces?
That may be some others, high-ranking officials, but there have been unconfirmed reports that the uncle was killed by a pack of rabid dogs in a cage who tore at him. There have been reports that he was shot down with, automatic rifles. There have been some gruesome reports, but these are kind of credible. You know, they sound outrageous, outlandish, but in the North Korean scheme of things, the primary purpose of such a high-profile public execution would be to terrify everyone. So I tend to believe these gruesome stories, as absurd as they sound.
Well, you mentioned Kim Jong-un's cousin, Lee Hwang-young. He was murdered in Seoul in 1997. Yes. And you mentioned the other young woman who was captured, who placed the bomb on the South Korean airliner that blew up on its approach to Bangkok over the Andaman Sea, killing all aboard. Mm-hmm. They were pretty horrendous incidents. And then, of course, you go back to the raid on the Blue House, the South Korean presidential residence, in 1968. That resulted in a huge shootout. You had the bombing in Burma in 1983, when many members of the South Korean cabinet were blown up, and the president only survived because his car got stuck in traffic. And then you had these many abductions in the 1970s and the 1980s, including Japanese actors and actresses and movie directors, etc. And then you had the murdering of a South Korean consul general in Vladivostok, where apparently there is a North Korean community in the Russian Pacific port of Vladivostok.
Yes.
And then you had this other incident that you just mentioned. So the question would be then, given the history going through the dynasty of the grandfather, the father, and now the grandson, who's the younger one that's running the country now, is it any better or any worse? Is just this is just business as usual, or is this young guy more desperate? Because I've heard reports that there's some disquiet amongst the North Korean elite. Not, I'm sure they're nervous as hell since he's murdered so many of them. But is there any possibility that there could be a coup against this guy if the top-ranked people are, you know, either don't want him or want to preemptively get him before he gets them?
You know, when it happens, if and ever it happens, an assassination or a coup, a rebellion, then the reasons will become all of a sudden very clear, because the repression, the extreme repression and the terrible conditions of life in North Korea were so unbearable, it had to happen. But as of now, we don't see any imminent signs. We don't see any opposition groups, rebels, preparing to launch a coup or anything like that. Of course, North Korea remains most obtuse, and it's very hard to gain credible information from North Korea. So we may just not be able to read the situation sitting where we are today outside North Korea. But I think with time, the probability of some kind of an attempt to remove Kim Jong-un only increases, because life will not get better for the vast majority of the North Korean people. The economic disparity between North Korea and that other Korean state, the one that is very affluent and quite free and democratic, that gap will only increase. And that means with time, as time passes on, Kim's legitimacy, North Korea's raison d'etre even, why does it need to exist? That question will be increasingly more difficult to answer for the Kim regime.
But everybody's always assumed that the people that really have influence are the Chinese, and there's always been this vain hope on the part of the United States that somehow they can persuade the Chinese to intervene and, you know, make this character behave himself. And it never happens. And one of the reasons I was told by a Korean specialist was that the Chinese don't mind the fact that Kim Jong-un's regime with its nuclear weapons is such a wild card that it makes the U.S. nervous, and particularly now that they have intermediate range ballistic missiles, therefore could neutralize the American presence in the Pacific, you know, the bases like Guam, etc. And the idea being that, you know, if you've got a mad dog on a chain, then, you know, you're the one that can, you know, loose the chain or not. You know, it's the same relationship, for example, that the Iranian hardline regime have with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is their hedge against Israel. And in this scenario, the Chinese tolerate the North Koreans because they are an extra form of deterrence against the United States, because, you know, the U.S. and China have nuclear parity and they understand the nature of deterrence. And the assumption is that the North Korean regime is so unstable that deterrence and mutually assured destruction doesn't necessarily come into the equation.
I agree with that view. And if I were to approach this issue with an amoral perspective of international relations, I hope you or our listeners won't say I'm immoral, but from an amoral perspective, China has no reason to give up North Korea. China has no reason to listen to the United States, which, after all, is China's biggest long-term strategic competitor. China is very fine with holding on to that North Korea card and having successive U.S. administrations defer to China, beg to China to rein North Korea in. China has probably, since the mid-19th century, since the first Opium Wars of the mid-19th century, China probably today has the greatest political, economic leverage, influence over both North Korea and South Korea. Why would China say goodbye to North Korea and put up with a united Korea that may remain pro-China still, but will decidedly be pro-US? So China is pretty fine. And when you think of Sino-North Korea relations over the past six, seven decades, you know, it's an alliance cemented in blood, the China-North Korea alliance. Many people were sacrificed in the Korean War. Many Chinese were sacrificed. And of China's 14 neighbors contiguously by land, I think China has had probably the closest relationship with North Korea over the past 6 or 7 decades. It's been a frosty relationship. North Korean leaders have blatantly insulted, offended Chinese leaders like Mao and Deng. But the Chinese are, you know, they're grown-ups. They grit their teeth and go on supporting North Korea. The Chinese lose face with each incident like this when North Korea turns to a nuclear test or a long-range missile test or something so brazen like this. The Chinese don't like it, but they can live with it, and they feel no threat whatsoever from a tiny North Korea that depends on China for survival, a North Korea armed with a few nukes when China is surrounded by bigger powers with nuclear weapons.
Well, just in closing, the Trump White House, of course, they sent out this belligerent young aide, Stephen Miller, to make bellicose noises about, this North Korean missile launch that took place while Trump was hosting the Japanese Prime Minister down at his golf course in Florida. But, you know, I don't see the Trump people doing anything. I mean, it's all very well to puff your chest out and say belligerent things. At the end of the day, no American administration has figured out what to do about this situation, have they? So I don't see any change, do you? Except the more bluff and bluster on our side.
Yeah, I think being verbose, resorting to bluster, even if it's, you know, justifiable, doesn't really advance your interests, U.S. interests. Over the past quarter century, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and also Chinese leaders and South Korean and Japanese leaders have all sung the popular refrain with each North Korean provocation. This is unacceptable. This is a serious provocation. It's intolerable. There will be serious consequences. No, there has been no serious consequence for North Korea. No punishment worthy of the name has ever been meted out to North Korea. So rather than be emotional and huff and puff, I think it's much better to say as little as possible, but carry a big stick. What kind of stick? Go after the money trail. Financially squeeze North Korea. North Korea still depends on the dollar system, international transactions conducted in U.S. dollars.
Even forged ones, right?
That's right. So, secondary sanctions, so-called. Right. Go after the primary target, which is North Korea, but also North Korea's partners, which are usually mostly Chinese entities. Right. This is not a radical departure. It's not something that's unfairly levied at North Korea. It's been used against Iran and many other countries by the EU, by the United States. The U.S. has still yet to enforce these sanctions, provisions, mandatory sanctions, which are in the new North Korea sanctions legislation that became law last year. So there is some financial leverage at America's disposal. Whether the Trump administration will have the stomach to escalate, if you will, to take a risk by pushing North Korea into a corner, by squeezing it financially or not, remains to be seen.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sung-Yun Lee.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yun Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Caracas, Venezuela, to look into the sanctions levied today against Venezuela's vice president, who's accused of being a drug kingpin.
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and he's also a professor of sociology at Tulane University. And he has researched Venezuela for the last 22 years and has lived there for a total of 12 years, during which time he's taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. And he moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you for calling.
And David, today, ahead of the press conference, or it was in the press conference today, where all the reporters, of course, are waiting to talk to the press secretary about the firing or resignation of General Flynn as the head of the National Security Council, they trotted out the new Secretary of Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, to start off the press conference, and he announced these sanctions against the Vice President of Venezuela, labeling him as a drug kingpin, along with his alleged frontman, Samarco Lopez, and of course the Vice President, Tariq El-Asimi, I guess is Asami, I should say, has already said that these charges are imperialistic aggression. So how's it playing down in Venezuela?
Well, it's interesting, because the government, the content of the response of the government has been pretty standard. You know, it's standard anti-imperialist rhetoric. What's been conspicuous is first that Maduro didn't say anything for about 18 hours. He left it to others. Now, finally, he has said something in the past hour. But they don't mention Trump by name, no. And so they give all the standard rhetoric about this being a violation of sovereignty and this being imperialist and this being, a conspiracy from the Venezuelan right wing working through the U.S. government. But they don't mention Trump by name, and that's quite interesting because there's been a lot of anticipation in Venezuela that, given that Trump has this America's First policy, and given that Trump has a close relationship with Putin, and that Maduro has a close relationship with Putin, that this could mean that the U.S. will essentially leave Venezuela alone. And so this really troubles that hope, but I think they still have some hope that this will happen, and for that reason are not naming Trump directly.
Well, we've already had the arrest of relatives of the First Lady, Maduro's wife, have we not, on drug charges?
Yeah, and there's been a number of other people, that have been tried for corruption and whatnot. I mean, what's different here is that this is, and if I'm not mistaken, this is the highest governing official ever sanctioned by the U.S. government. I mean, he's the vice president. He's the second in line in Venezuela, and he's being sanctioned. I mean, this is really unprecedented. And so, this is quite different than just the nephews of the First Lady being tried for drug trafficking. No, it's quite troubling. It's troubling for Venezuelans, but I think really, this is really troubling for Venezuelan democracy because basically, you have now somebody that has all the levers of power. He's in a very powerful position that has a huge incentive for that to be any sort of democratic transition. I remember that Venezuela suspended the recall referendum that was underway last October and basically has not announced any new elections. And so for now, there's no electoral democracy in Venezuela, and there's been, a lot of anticipation what should happen, what kind of dialogue should happen or negotiations should happen for a return to electoral democracy. This makes it very unlikely because El-Aissami knows that if there's a return to electoral democracy, the opposition is going to win and take power. And if the opposition wins and takes power, they're going to extradite him. And so he has every interest imaginable to try and prevent any sort of democratic transition, and that's a real problem.
And what's the sense then of how what the validity is here? There have been all kinds of rumors about Venezuela becoming a hub for drug trafficking from Colombia and into the Caribbean, into Mexico, and that's the charges here. against the vice president, that he was involved with the Zetas, which is an extremely violent drug gang in Mexico, and delivering Colombian and protecting a Colombian narco kingpin, and trafficking cocaine into Mexico to the Zetas, and of course on its then onto the United States.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know. I mean, that really depends on the quality of their investigation. I mean, they have spent several years on this investigation. This all surfaced already 4 or 5 years ago, and it's been public knowledge that they've been investigating this. And so one hopes or supposes that they've been fairly careful in that, although I'm sure that's, you know, some of these claims are probably exaggerated, but you know, it seems quite likely, and that this could be completely true. And so, you know, I think the issue for most of us is, you know, how is this done? When is it done? No, I think doing this right now, when this guy is vice president, I think is really not a good thing for the future of Venezuelan democracy. I mean, you know, this person, like everyone else, should be responsible for their actions. But the U.S. government knows very well that you know, timing means a lot, and apparently this case was ready months ago during the Obama administration, and they sat on it because they saw that there was a dialogue process going on and thought that, you know, bringing it out last October, November might impede that, and so they sat on it. But now that dialogue has broken down, it's not going anywhere, and Trump comes along and doesn't have the same sort of caution as the Obama administration does, and so they brought this out, and I think it's going to have quite a negative impact.
Well, it was pretty clear that that Mnuchin showed up today as a way to distract them from the press, because it preceded the statements by the press secretary, who himself is sort of somewhat under siege. So everybody's waiting to hear about the General Flynn story, and Mnuchin comes out and makes this statement, which I think it's clearly they're trying to take the eye off the ball here. And of course, Mnuchin talked about how the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, are the ones that have seized the money, and he alluded to a considerable amount of money without giving an actual figure. So some money clearly has been frozen. Whether it belongs to Venezuela's vice president or not, I guess we have to wait to see, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's apparently this guy was a front, and so he, you know, they said they wasn't sure, I'm not sure if it was Mnuchin or someone else that trotted out the figure of tens of millions of dollars, which could well be the case. Yeah, I think it's interesting because, as we've talked about before, there's been a lot of speculation by myself and others about what a Trump policy towards Venezuela will look like, precisely because of this relationship with Putin and this America's First emphasis, and speculation that perhaps, you know, he's just not going to pay any attention to Venezuela whatsoever. But, you know, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of reasons why this could actually work in Trump's interests. No, for the same reason that Nicolas Maduro continually trots out international conspiracy theories, well, I think it works quite well, as we're seeing today, for the Trump administration to use sanctions or tough talk on Venezuela, you know, as a way to sort of distract from its own internal problems that it has right now. I think we saw that in the press conference today. And, you know, it could have this, Venezuela could play this role, I think, in the future. It could be, you know, a way for it. It's always in the interest of presidents to have some sort of foreign enemy, you know, for that reason, that it can distract people from criticism of their own government.
Well, there's also another element to this story, because the CNN and CNN en Español, they've been investigating the vice president, El Assami, for at least a year. And apparently they got hold of a confidential intelligence document that links El Asami to 173 Venezuelan passports and IDs that were issued to Middle Eastern individuals of Middle Eastern descent from Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iran, and Iraq. And the allegation is that some of these people are involved with the with Hezbollah. So so that's another dimension. Whether that's another, that's what the real investigation is about, and drugs are being used as a way to you know, go after this guy. Not to suggest that maybe they, I'm not saying one way or the other whether these accusations are true, but there is this other dimension, is there not? That he could be supplying, be a means for aiding and abetting terrorists, presumably in this hemisphere, that could end up here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an issue. That's a more recently breaking issue. I mean, there's long been accusations that he's had some ties to Hezbollah and other groups. I mean, those haven't gotten too far. But more recently, there's been this breaking news about, you know, the sale of Venezuelan passports in Iraq and who those were sold to. And so, you know, I think that's a problem. That's a brewing problem as well. You know, this putting El Asami on the OFAC list, I think, has been quite a long time coming. It was sort of an easy plum to pick for the Trump government, and we'll see where this goes. You know, where the issue of passports goes with this government. You know, with the Trump government and its emphasis on securing the borders and whatnot. It's sort of I shudder to think what they could do with that.
But just at the end of the day, is there his ethnic origins? He's got some. He's been in Venezuela for some time, I believe. The family has, but there is a diaspora of Middle Eastern origin, is there not, in Venezuela?
Yeah, he's born Venezuelan. One of his parents is from Lebanon, and one is from Syria. And so, and yeah, there has been, you know, over the last 50 years, there's been a reasonably large immigration of people from Arab countries. No, and Venezuela, actually, they're quite respected and valued in Venezuela as very hardworking and prosperous and good as citizens.
Well, I thank you for joining us, David Smalley, from Caracas, Venezuela.
All right. Thank you for calling.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela. And he's also a professor of sociology at Tulane University and has researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and has lived there for a total of 12 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.